every phi x, so every interaction term is upper bounded by some constant, by the same constant h. So we found that we can put a norm, we can put an upper bound to the norm of this commutator. And we wrote the bound in this way, 2a b e to the, so we have this, bt minus d a b. Okay. So I want to start by doing some, making some comments on this bound, because this is, you know, this is a very good bound because it's an exponential decay. However, it's still very loose. So it's loose in many ways. So let's see how we can make it a little bit more tight. So first of all, an essential point in our argument was that, so if you remember, we were binding this object as 2a b, and then we had some series. Here we had 2t h sigma to the n over n factorial. And then we had the number of paths that we called sigma n. And we said that this number can be upper bounded by, in any case, by e to the nr minus t, which is true. But actually, this bound is perfectly valid for every mu greater than 0. So for the same argument that we said yesterday, this object is still greater than 0 in any case, and still greater than 1 when the nr is larger than d. Okay, so this is all we need for every mu greater than 0. So what this means that our bound becomes it becomes this one. Yeah. A mu here, where now b, where now b is almost the same thing, but there is mu. It's 2h sigma e to the mu r over mu. Okay. So our speed is parameterized by this mu, that is any number greater than 0. So we, in order to get the tightest number, we want to minimize b with respect to mu. So, so this is a simple exercise, and you find that, so we call mu the value such that v is minimum, something around two point something. Okay, so we've made it a little bit tighter. However, we have two big sources of looseness in the proof. And if you remember the ingredients of the proof, we do two very horrible things. The very first horrible thing that we do, actually we do three very horrible things. So the very first horrible thing that we do is that we have some of, you know, we have objects like this. And actually, these are double commutators. And when we bound, first of all, we keep
taking inside these norms. And then when we take them inside, then we take them inside, also inside the commutator. So in the end, we get things like 2AB, and then times 2C, and so on and so forth, right? So by taking the norm of the commutator, we are, and without looking what these operators do, but you see, we have the norm of the sum of the commutators. So by applying continuously this triangular inequality, so we are denying the possibility that these terms cancel partially, which can happen, which will in principle happen. But we are just doing an upper bound, so we don't care, because it works as an upper bound, however it is loose. Okay? The second very large source of looseness is in this one, because we have, in the end, remember, you have the product over all the sum over all the possible paths of the product over all these paths of these norms. And so this is a path of length n. And we decide that this is smaller than h to the n because this is the bound common to all of them. However, this is very, very loose, right? Because maybe you have one of them that is very large, and then it rules on everything. So let me give you a concrete example. In one of the next lectures, we will see that there are lattice models, for instance, a square lattice, whose emergent, so it's a spin model, lattice spin model, whose emergent excitations are photons, which is very interesting because, so photons do not need to be elementary particles, but they can be emergent particles. And the Hamiltonian will be written, is the sum of two local terms. One is like a plaquette term, means it couples these spins. And it has some coupling constant that I will call H1. And the other term is a link term that only contains one spin. So I am putting the spins on the edges of the lattice. I have a Hamiltonian that is basically the sum. So this will have a coupling H2. And my Hamiltonian is the sum of these two local terms. Very simple. Like a very simple Hamiltonian. I'm not telling right now how these spins are coupled, because it goes beyond our goal right now. And light happens in the limit of H1 much larger than H2. So in this limit, the emergent excitations, one can show that they are photons, okay? However, so H1 and H2 play the role of epsilon 0 and mu 0 in electromagnetism. Basically, H1 is epsilon 0, 1 over epsilon 0, and H2 is mu 0. Okay, and you know that the speed of light is this guy. Right? In electromagnetism. However, if you do the Lieb-Robinson bounds, you will find that you cannot have you cannot have signals that travel at a speed greater than H1. You see, our speed is proportional to the biggest of the coupling constants. Whereas our real speed of light is the square root of h1, h2, which is much smaller than h1. So the bound is not wrong, it's just loose. We are saying we cannot have signals traveling faster than this by using the Lieber-Robinson bounds. However, we know that we cannot have signals traveling faster than this. Okay, so it's not a contradiction. I'm just showing that the bound can be loose. So you see, sometimes this bound depends how you use it. You can only use it to be sure that nothing happens outside that light cone. It doesn't mean that there is not a tighter light cone inside. By the way, in this model, if you adapt the proof to this model, you will see that all these terms commute, and all these terms commute. So if you use this fact inside the proof of the Lieber-Robinson bounds, you will see that the only sequences of interactions, okay? So remember, our commutator is upper bounded by a sum of interactions along some path that connects A and B. We are summing over all the possible paths, right? This is what we are doing. But these come from the fact that we expand the commutator, right? But every time a commutator is zero, one of these paths gets deleted. But now you see that if I have this path, a path made like this, this will not count because the plaquettes commute. So in fact, the only paths that are valid are those that are made in this way. And so on and so forth, right? I have a plaquette, a link, a plaquette, a link, a plaquette, a link. So this means that I can upper bound the only paths that count. Every time I have a plaquette, I upper bound it with h1. But how many of them there are? N over 2. And every time I have a link, which happens n over 2 times, I upper bound it in this way. So you see that the final coupling, you know, the final speed will be proportional to this, which is exactly this, the right speed of light. So this is of fundamental importance because when we have emergent light, we can prove that the speed of the emergent light is the maximum speed of signals in the model. Okay, so this is not so in electromagnetism or QED. That's assumed from the beginning because you write the theory explicitly Lorentz invariant. This theory is not Lorentz invariant because you have photons only at low energy. If you go at the lattice level, a very short distance, at high energy, you have other excitations that are not photons that can be, you know, that could be in principle faster, although they are not there. But the model does break Lorentz invariance. If there is Lorentz invariance, can be only emergent. So at some larger distance, at the lattice distance, can be broken. Okay. The other interesting thing about the Lieber-Robinson bounds is that, you see, we are using this thing. We are only dealing with finite dimensional Hilbert space such that all the operators are upper bounded. Indeed, it is possible to build some model Hamiltonians for, I don't know, some system of bosons, for instance, such that there is no Lib-Robinson speed, such that there is no upper bound to how fast your excitations can travel, basically because this object is not upper bound. So we want to understand how reasonable is this assumption, and or how reasonable are these other models in which this assumption fails and we do not have a Lib-Robinson speed. Okay, so you know, we would like to have a system made of bosons or things like harmonic oscillators that are interacting. Right? So they in principle you can have any energy to them. Right? In principle. So however, so the difference between a system which can host any amount of energy, that, you see, there is a mathematical difficulty. If phi is some Hermitian operator on a Hilbert space, its norm is not upper bounded, this means that the expectation value of this can be any large number that you want. So the expectation value is what is physical. The norm is just the worst case scenario. So saying that the norm is infinity is saying, oh, in principle, you know, I can have infinite energy there, but that would not be physical. However, the only way to have a system that does not have an upper bound to how much the expectation value is to have a norm infinity. So physically, you can always have only local finite, you know, it must be finite, even if there is no fixed number to how big this one is. And physically, this is always, by the way, how do we know that the system has some energy? We only know it when it exchanges energy. So it is only energy exchanges that we see. Like for instance, when we look at the spectrum of an atom, we see the energy of the photons that have been emitted, right? We always, in other words, we always see energy gaps. You know, energy is not defined, you know, absolutely. It's always a difference of energy. So here energy is exchanged in interactions, and the interactions is a commutator. So what must be physically bound is the norm, if a norm must be physically bound, is the norm of a commutator. This is an overkill. This is too much. It happens that in the models that do not have a Lib-Robinson speed, not only they have unbounded operators, but they also have unbounded commutators. So the question is, if we have a system with unbounded operators, but such that every time they exchange energy, they exchange it in a finite way, so the commutator is bounded, can we still have a Lib-Robinson bound? Well, the proof as it is doesn't work. So is there another proof? So the answer is yes. So it has been proven, and it's much more complicated and hairy. But you can prove that you get a Lib-Robinson speed by bounding just the commutators. Okay. Yep.
What can we say that the commutator is something representing the exchange of energy? Like it is change of order of measurement.
Because of the Schrödinger equation, because of the Heisenberg equation, evolution only happens. Evolution is a sum of commutators. Which is, in fact, what we have done in the Lib-Robinson proof. If you have a system where nothing commutes, it's then there is no evolution.
The Heisenberg equation just represents how the operator changes the time. That doesn't really tell if there are two different systems, and two systems are interchanging some amount of energy through some channel. But it is not.
So whatever you can observe is some Hermitian operator, and this proof is for every Hermitian operator. If they are evolving, means they must not commute. So if you have, for instance, some quasi-particle, means that, you know, you can follow the local energy density of this quasi-particle along the chain. This is what it means. So it is within the scopes of this theorem. Another comment about the fuzziness, okay? So you might be tempted to say that this is very remarkable, right? That we make it emerge. However, we pay a price, you may say, because when we impose Lorentz invariant not as emergent, when we impose a sharplet cone, it's a sharplet cone. Here, you have some evanescent signal outside of the light cone. However, you know, it could be not observable, right? Because it decays very fast. So it seems that we actually do pay a price, right? We don't get the real thing, it would seem. So question, why do you think we don't get a sharp light cone? This has nothing to do with the looseness of the bound. The looseness of the bound just means that we are overestimating the speed. But given the speed, why we are not able to get something that is really sharp? Where do you think, this is not an easy question. So it's not quantum mechanics 101, but why do you think that in the proof there is the part where, it's here that the fuzziness happens? Yeah?
I mean, you can't, you know, arbitrarily precisely define a position. So in this sense,
say it louder, please.
Arbitrarily precisely define position of the mechanics, right? So to say like the causal boundary is exactly here.
Oh, this is such a good answer. Thank you. Okay. So the yeah, so your colleague says, we are on a graph. So because we are on a graph, you know, there is some uncertainty due to this, right? To this distance. So it turns out that it is like this, but let's try to see it more really precisely. So in our language or graph theory, this distance is one. Right, but actually cannot be one. So this is a very profound question. What is the fundamental unit of length? Okay, so what gives us the fundamental unit of length? So we are not trying to answer this question now, but let's say that this fundamental unit of length is not one, but it is A. So we are now embedding the graph in the continuum space. Okay. What happens when we have an operator here, an operator here that somehow overlap? That on this distance A, the interaction is instantaneous. So we have a sort of action at a distance, at a short scale distance, because we are basically neglecting the fact that there is a real distance between two objects that are nearest neighbors. Well, how do we deal with this? Well, this is not, once we have embedded the graph in real space, now we know the distance between two points A and B is equal to the graph distance between A and B times A. And the speed measured now in a real metric space will be L over AT. Right? The, this speed here, now it's this, just because d has become L over A. This was defined this way. Okay? And now let me define this object, let me define V over A, right? Because V tilde is L over T. Right? The speed that we actually can measure, not in graph distance, but in the real distance, is L over T, and then there is this constant A. Well, if I plug this thing in there, this becomes, on the lattice, becomes, apart from the prefactor, e to mu over A, V tilde T minus L. Okay. So this is perfectly valid. Now imagine that we go to the continuum limit, or at a very large distance, which is the same thing. So either we send A to zero, or we consider L very large. So in high energy, people like to think that they're sending A to zero, so it's, everything is continuous. So let's think in that way. If we send A to zero, now you see that this becomes sharp. In the limit A to zero, this becomes sharp. So the only fuzziness comes from the fact that it's a lattice model. In the continuum, we do have a sharp light cone emergent. So we're not really paying a price for not starting with the relativistic theory. Okay. No, no, time is not discrete. Yeah, but I mean, this is right, but I wouldn't say that the reason is because we do not treat space and time in the same way. In fact, I don't know. So in fact, I don't even know how I would manage to do this proof with the discrete time. So, okay, so this is an interesting question, but I don't know the answer. So this is a proof that is contained within the framework of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, in which T is continuous and is very well defined, and it's common for all the observers, et cetera. So in fact, I'm not saying that the theory becomes Lorentz invariant. I'm just saying that it gains one of the characteristics of a Lorentz invariant theory, that is the light cone. Okay, so let's see some applications. So the first thing that I tried to argue in perturbation theory was that if we bound the commutator, then we cannot send signals away from the outside from the light cone, right? But now we want to see it precisely. So no, let's prove no signaling. Again, by no signaling, I mean that the signal is evanescent and decays exponentially, and is zero in the continuum limit. OK, so how do we prove it? So the proof also is very instructive. So imagine that we have a region A on which we can do some quantum operation, and the region B, where we can read out, we can make measurements, we can read out some outcome from some experiment. And the rest of my system is called C, okay? So for us to do a signal means to start from a state that I call rho zero, and just to make sure, I write A, B, C here to make it clear that the support of the state is the whole space. So we have any state on the Hilbert space of A, B, and C. Okay, so rho is a state in here. Then we do some quantum operation only in A. So what does it mean? How do we model a quantum operation in A? We do some operation that we label by K. So K, by this label just means I can do different operations. And it has support on A. Well, for the sake of simplicity and just to make the proof simpler, we can assume that U is unitary. We can do the proof also without a unitary operation. But let's assume that what we do is to rotate some degrees of freedom. So we do a unitary operation on A. And we use the label k equals 0 for the do nothing operation. So we do nothing on A. So U0A is the identity on A. Okay? So after we do this operation, we have our input state. It's our signal that we want to send. So our input state, that is still a state on ABC, now is labeled by K because it depends on this operation, right? So it's UK A, rho 0, U dagger K A. So it is what happens to the global state after I've done an operation only on A. Very well. Okay. Now we have some Hamiltonian, H, that is the generator of the time evolution. And as we know, this UOT, let me spell it out here for now, then I will drop it. We just learned that even if the Hamiltonian is local, the time evolution is non-local, right? Because I'm exponentiating. So U has support everywhere. So mind that this U is not the time evolution, it's our operation, and it is local. And this one is the time evolution, it has support everywhere, okay? Okay, so now we wait a time t, and then we want to make an experiment on B and read out something. So what is the state that contains all the information about all the possible outcomes of experiments on B? Is the so-called partial state on B, which is defined in this way. Is, so I take my total state, rho k abc, then now it's evolving in time. You know that by this, what I mean is ut rho k u dagger t. This ut is this one, okay? So this is the total state, but then I can trace out everything that is in A and C. After I do the trace, the marginal state represents all that we can measure on B. In fact, it's a very simple exercise that at least once in your life you should do, that if I take an observable with support in B, and I've computed the expectation value of this observable in this state or in the total state, the expectation value must be the same. Very well. So let's take this observable, OB of T, and this must depend on K, right? So this is the expectation value of my observable B in this state. So this state depends on T and on K. So this is defined like the trace. So of my observable in B on this state. This was just, I said in words a minute ago. It's the expectation value of OB in sigma KB of T. Okay. So this means that after a time T, we will measure this, this expectation value. And I want to see if a signal arrived. So the only way to know it is to compute the difference between O0 B of T, which, because I will measure something even if I don't send any signal. This observable will have some expectation value. But this value is the background, it's no signal. So you want to measure this quantity. So if I read out a number that is different from zero, a signal has arrived in B at the time T. Okay, let's see what this is. So this is the this trace minus this trace, which means it's the trace of OB times the difference between the two states. Okay. So now you see that I can pull out the U's from here. So this is equal to the trace of OB U T delta sigma U dagger T. By delta sigma, I just mean the difference between sigma 0b and sigma kb at time equals 0. But now these are inside the trace, so I can put this, I can cycle them, I can put the u dagger in front of everything. So this becomes the absolute value of the trace of OB of t times this delta, let me write it as it is, rho k. Oh, it's sigma 0. However, this exercise that you do once in your lifetime tells you that this expectation value, as I said, is the same if you take it in the partial state or in the total state. Yeah.
We have taken out the time evolution of the partial states.
Mm.
But given that the Hamiltonian, that the unitary evolution will not necessarily be separable, that means that sigma does not actually evolve unitarily. It may evolve.
You're very right. I made a mistake. No, you are very right. So you are very right. This is a bad mistake. So what it means is that what I should do is that from the at this stage, so before I take it out, at this stage, so thank you for your comments. So your colleague is right. I cannot assume that. So I can still take it out, but after the trace, I cannot assume it's a unitary operator anymore. This is what I cannot assume. However, what I can do is that at this stage, I can use rho, because I'm measuring them on OB. At this stage, I do this. And now I take out the U's, and now they are unitary operators, because they're not partial. Very good, very good. This now, it must be this. Okay.
I'm a bit confused about the notation. So is the row represent the row ABC here?
It's all here. Row zero is this.
Okay.
And row K ABC is this guy that I will also call row K of T. So for me, the row is the total state on ABC always. And the difference between row 0 and row k is the initial condition.
So may I understand it as like you extend the operator OB into the ABC space by tensor product in identity?
Oh, but yeah, but of course. Of course. So we know from the beginning, every time I write something, it's like when I write this, because this is an operator on the total Hilbert space, what I mean is always this. Or when you write the Ising model, right? So first of all, if you want to be pedant, you should put the tensor product here, and then you should tensor the identity everywhere else. Then it becomes a bit cumbersome, right? So we know what we mean. It means the identity everywhere else. OK. So we have this guy here. So I'm afraid that I made this mistake in the notes. So no, it's exactly, it is in this way. OK, so now there is a bit of algebra that is always very time consuming. So this is the trace of OB of T. OK, you will find the passage in the notes. I don't, because I have to prove something else. So this is just algebra. You massage a little bit all this, you know, doing the trick with the trace, inserting some unitary operators. In the end, what you find is that this is the absolute value of the trace of row 0 UK DAG array times the commutator of OB of T commuting with UKA. So it's this trace absolute value. So it's the expectation value of this operator. So any expectation value is upper bounded by the norm of this operator. So I can just take the norm of all that is inside here. But this is a state, so this is norm one. This is a unitary operator, so it does norm one. And this is the commutator that we want. It's OB of T UKA. So you see, this is a norm, the norm of a commutator between an operator with support on A and my evolved operator that has initial support on B. It's exactly what happens in the Liebig-Robinson bounds. So this one is upper bounded by e to the minus vt minus d over some number xi. So there is no signal. This difference, that is the signal, must decay very fast outside of the light cone, and in the continuum limit is 0. So no signal. Which is very interesting, since we started with the theory in which signaling is possible in theory, because there is, we are not imposing it. Right? Another interesting result is what we call the truncation of local operators. So what do I mean? I have a local operator OA. And then I have my UT that is non-local. And all our problems were starting from the fact that when I evolve OA, this is UT OA. Let me put some caps. And now this is non-local. So all our problems started from the fact that this is A. My operator is local, But for every t, no matter how small it is, now its support is everywhere. And what we've proven is that, the support is everywhere, but it almost commutes the same, even if it is away from the light cone. So what we would like to show now is that we can do better than this. Actually, that this is the same thing than saying, but we need to prove it, that so at time t equals 0, my support is only on A. It would be very nice if we could show that if we wait a time t, the support gets extended by a length L, by a radius L, that goes like a vt. It would be nice to say that my OA of t is actually similar to something that I called OA plus L of t. So this is non-local because it's this guy in principle. But I would like to say, oh, it's almost the same than one that is local, just with a larger support because it has evolved, but cannot have covered more than this. Right? It would be very cool if you could prove it. So let's do it. So to prove this, we need a beautiful tool in group theory and quantum statistical mechanics that is the average over the Hilbert space. So let me do a small detour. Imagine that I take a state in the Hilbert space. I take it randomly, right? And I ask you, what is the average state on the Hilbert space? So what if I have some measure on these states, and I sum over all the Hilbert space, what do I get? So in order to do it properly, I actually cannot do it like this because this looks like a coherent superposition, right? So it's not exactly what we mean by average. By average, we mean if we have a mixture, we take the state with some probability. Well, this is not a big deal. We just need to write the density. That's why we need density matrices. Okay, so this is the question. What is the average state on the Hilbert space? So we need to understand how to make average. So this measure is called R measure. It's the unitarily invariant measure on the Hilbert space. Its only relevant property is that it's invariant under unitary operations. And by the way, because for every state psi, there is for every pair psi and psi prime, there is a unitary operator such that psi is equal to u psi prime. Averaging over all the states is the same thing than averaging over all the unitaries. In fact, the R measure, we can consider it like the measure onto the unitary group. So we would write this thing in this way, like u. We start from some state psi 0, u dagger, the u. Because by varying u, we recover all the Hilbert space, starting from psi 0, right? Because for every state in the Hilbert space, there is a u. So we need to do this. So in group theory, you probably done the Schultz lemma. What the Schultz lemma tells you is that the average over a group must be in the constant of the group. Okay. So something went off the record. All right. So I cannot prove you this lemma now, but to be in the commutant of a group, means that this state must be equal to, so it's a linear combination over all the invariant subspaces of the group. So if I labels the invariant subspaces, so and now I am talking a bit loosely. What do I mean when I say the invariant subspace of a group? What do I mean? So groups are represented. So we have operations on a linear space. So the subspace is a linear space notion. So we have group elements that now then are represented as matrices on some linear space. And there can be invariant subspaces of the linear space under the action of this matrix. And if, so this is called a representation. If there are invariant subspaces, this is a reducible representation. So I is labeling, in fact, the irreducible representations. Okay, so it's a linear combination over the projectors onto the invariant subspaces with some coefficients that are given by the trace of, let me write it like this, of pi I times psi over the trace of pi I. So if you do this for if these in fact are states in the Hilbert space, how many, so what is U? U is the standard trivial representation, which U as a group element is associated to U as a unitary matrix. So there are no invariant subspaces. So the only non-trivial invariant subspaces means the only invariant subspace is the whole space itself, which means that the projector is the identity. So this is equal to the identity. So this means that the trace of pi psi is the trace of psi, that is one. And here you have the trace of the identity, that is the dimension of the Hilbert space, and pi is the identity. So little theorem, the average state is the completely mixed state. Not so surprisingly, but it is the completely mixed state. Now, this stuff is the same even if I don't start with this operator, that is the density operator, but with some other operator. So everything carries out up to here, where I have this trace. So what we get is that this is the trace of O this time over times the completely mixed state. So let me call this number C. Okay, so now let's do a little bit more step. What happens if instead of averaging over the whole Hilbert space, I average onto a subspace of the Hilbert space? So what happens if I do the average over Ux with some support? Well, what you get is, so actually it's the same proof, but the result is, what you get is that you get O, so you trace out the complement from X. So this does not get averaged. And then the rest gets averaged. But now this is the dimension of the Hilbert space only on X. And we get to this C. Okay, so this is the tool that we need. Why I'm doing this? So let's keep this object here. Sorry?
Like, how did you get X to a bar here? Like, is it like trace of
Yeah, so I'm saying that the Hilbert space is Hx tensor Hx bar. This is what I'm saying. It's just the complement of X. So what I'm saying is that when you do this average, basically you leave the X bar alone because I'm only averaging on X. One can prove this. Okay, but now, so you see, we see that the partial average is something that we like because it's something that has, is the identity somewhere, and then it's local. Okay, so how do we use this? So let's use it in this way. So let me redo this drawing. Let me call this A, this is L, and this is S. So for me, S are all the spins that are some distance between A, the spins that is greater or equal to L. Okay? So all the spins that are outside of this ball. Very good. And now I want to define this operator here in this way, in a very natural way. So I define this guy, the one that has only support on here, in this way. I take my real operator OA of T. I multiply it by C because I need it. And then I trace out S. So this is what I get if I trace out everything outside. Tensor, now I need to be careful, the completely mixed state on S. In fact, I could put the C here. So you see that this is equal to this guy where we have done S. It's what we would obtain if we take the full O and average over S. Very good. So we can write now that the difference between my OA plus L of T and my full OA of T in norm is smaller than the integral over d mu US of the difference between this guy, US, OA of T, U dagger S, and OA of T. This is what we did. And of course, I can write this as the mu US. Because because U is unitary, I can write this as US OA of T minus OA of T US. I am just multiplying inside the norm by U dagger S, which I can because it doesn't change the norm. So I get this. Oh, but this is the commutator. So this is the average value of the commutator between US, of the norm of the commutator between US and OA of T. Now let's apply the Lib-Robinson bound. So this guy is upper bounded by, so we have the mu US, and then this guy is upper bounded by the norm of this times the norm of this times 2, But the norm of this is 1, because this is a unitary operator. So this is 2 OA, and then e to the bt minus r over xi. Now, this does not depend on you. So this is just the normalization, right? This is a probability distribution. So this is 1. So you got it. So you see the difference between the real operator evolved in time that has in principle support everywhere and the truncated one is small outside of the light cone. So truncation works. So in the next 3 minutes, let me show you that this also implies that also the spreading of correlations as a light cone. Why do I need to show that? So we know, we already know that there is no signaling. Does it mean that correlations cannot spread? Does it already imply it? No, because correlation is not causation, something weaker. Right? So you can, in principle, have correlations that do not have a cause. Right? You know, they just happen, things happen to be together. Okay. So let's show it. So what I want to do is the following. Imagine that we start with a state that has correlation length chi. Chi? Yes, chi. This means that if I take two observables between, what did they use, A and B? A and B, the connected correlation functions, by definition, what it means to have in psi, go like, are upper bounded by some constant C1, e to the minus dAB over chi. So this is the definition of for a state having a correlation length. Okay? So I start with a state like this. And then I wait a time t. And I wonder, after a time t, can my state have any correlation length? Or also the distance at which more degrees of freedom get correlated as to follow a light cone law? OK. So what we want to measure is this OA of t, OB of t, connected correlation function. So I'm letting the state evolve, so the observables evolve. And now I want to measure this. So what do I do? Is now I now use the truncated operators that we just saw that we can use. So I will first compute the correlation function of OA of t truncated to L and OB of t truncated to L. Plus, we have some error, right? Because there is some error due to the fact no, they're not exactly the same. This error depends on the length L. It's small only if I am outside of the light cone. OK, so let's evaluate these guys. So now, how can we bound these connected correlation functions here? Well, now these are local operators. The state is the same. Because you see, I used the Heisenberg representation. I am computing the evolved operators in the old state. So the old state has correlation length chi. However, now these two are not at the distance d, because they've grown. But their distance d is equal to dAB minus 2L. That's because this is A, but this is OA of L, OA truncated to L, and this is OB truncated to L. So their distance must be the initial distance minus 2L. So this part is upper bounded by C1 E to the, what is it, minus DAB minus 12 over chi. Well, what is this error? This error is some other constant that depends also on the norm of A and of B. So let me call it C2. And it's E to the VT minus L over psi. Right? I'm using the fact that I make this error when I substitute for the operators. So for sure, when I take expectation values, I don't get a bigger error. Because the norm is the worst case scenario. So you see, this bound is valid for every L. For every L. I have not used how big or how small L must be. So in particular, I can choose L. I choose L such that this equation is satisfied. And then now I solve for L and I plug it in here, which takes 5 minutes, so I don't do it. But if you solve for L and you plug it in here, what you get is C1 plus C2 exp of this quantity, 2VT minus DAB. The liberal response speed is 2V because now both OA and OB are growing, right? So the relative speed is 2V. But there is still a correlation length that is chi plus 2 xi. So it means that in the unit of time measured by the Lieber-Robinson speed, the relative Lieber-Robinson speed, I can only grow my correlation length of 2 xi. So I cannot instantaneously create correlations at distance. Sorry? So what I'm saying is that this is true for every L. So in particular, it's true for the L that solves this equation. So I pick this L. I choose L such that this is true. And then I put it in here. And then L disappears, right? And they get this.
But the last quality may not be true for the other L. Like, why do we actually pick the L to restrict the equation?
This does not depend on L. Look. This does not depend on L. So I've not done anything very esoteric. I'm saying, so this is all, because this is always true, it's also true when this is valid, but now this is then this is equal to this for the right L. But then, of course, it doesn't depend on L anymore. I wanted to eliminate L from it. I can choose L as I want. I can choose to truncate where I want to make the bound, right? So I truncate in a way such that I know that this expectation value is smaller than this quantity. The truncation is it's a virtual process in this proof. No, you know, depends. The larger is L, the smaller is this. But then, so I don't know. So right now I have to look. I don't know if this is the L such that this is the smallest possible correlation function. The point is that I don't care. I want a result that does not depend on L. I just want to show that you get after a time t, you get a new correlation length that is this. This is what I want to show. Okay. So tomorrow we will use all these tools that we'll learn. So all these things to prove the theorem that if you have a gap, then correlation functions decay exponentially. However, this is non-trivial because as you can see, everything here is in the time domain. This is a space-time statement. But that theorem is only space. You know, the correlation functions decay exponentially in space, not in space time. So it's not trivial, but we will prove it tomorrow.